This is a story about fish. More accurately, it's a story about all the fish that aren't there, that we never knew should be. Worrying about declining fish populations might feel like a modern problem from the era of big industry and climate change, but it's not. In parts of Canada, like the Skeena River system near Prince George in British Columbia, Canadians have been worried about the health of their fish for more than 100 years. As early as 1912, British Columbia officers were counting sockeye salmon in these creeks and rivers, and what they found troubled them. And then the research disappeared for more than 50 years. Boxes of handwritten journals, a picture of what a robust salmon population looked like, felt like, and even smelled like, all shut away somewhere, forgotten about. Until someone decided that we needed to dig that research up so that we could figure out just how much we don't know about the past and the present and probably the future of one of Canada's most iconic animals. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Alana Mitchell is a freelance science journalist who looked into the salmon journals for Maclean's. Hi, Alana.
Hi.
So why don't you just start by telling me about these field journals? Like, what are they? Describe them.
Oh, well, they're these little black notebooks with just, you know, that are 100 years old. They started to be filled in 100 years ago by fisheries officers in BC at the mouth of the Skeena River. And these fisheries officers were hired by the province to try to make sure that fish were going to be okay, because here was this new sockeye salmon fishery, or relatively new. It would have been going on for a few decades by then, but the BC government wanted to make sure that things were going to be okay. So they asked these fisheries officers to go and, you know, see what was being caught. And so these officers would take samples of the fish that were going into the cannery, and they would, you know, write down their weight and their sex and their size. And then they would scrape a few, you know, just a sort of a smear of scales off the side of one of these fish and glue it into the notebook. Yeah, with slime and blood and stuff.
Right.
And then, you know, go on to the next. So you'd have five entries per page, and then they'd go on to the next page. And
doing it fish by fish.
Fish by fish. Not every single fish, but,
right,
you know, a sample of the fish, just to see, you know, who was who. Who was being caught, and, you know, what effect it was going to be on the population. And so eventually these notebooks were then analyzed by one of the great fish biologists of the world. His name was Charlie Gilbert, and he was at Stanford University. And he was the one the BC government had hired to sort of oversee this project to see how the fish were doing. And so Charlie Gilbert would then look at these notebooks and assess the population based on what he found in these notebooks and give reports to the BC government about how the fish were doing.
First of all, it's just interesting to me that even back then, governments were concerned about levels of fish.
Yeah. And, you know, the other thing that is so captivating is just the idea of my editor at Maclean's was talking about this, the tenderness of, you know, these fisheries officers with, you know, their little notebooks and their ink fountain ink pens and, you know, just doing this real hands-on, you know, quite careful work.
So what happened to those journals over the years?
Those journals, well, they started in 1912. And they went until 1948, and then that whole program just stopped. But in the meantime, the notebooks themselves vanished from sight. And the only reason that we still know about these notebooks was that in the 1980s, a fisheries, he calls himself a sockeye oceanographer, and his name is Skip McKinnell, and he used to work for the federal government.
That's a movie character.
He's a wonderful, wonderful person. So he had read some of these original reports because he, you know, was looking at the health of the salmon. And he had read some of these original reports and thought, well, where are these notebooks? And so he started looking for them. And they'd been gone for 50 years by this point. Absolutely out of sight, out of mind. But he thought, you know, they must be somewhere. And so he started looking in archives. So he phoned down to Stanford and said, you know, are these archives down there? Are these notebooks down there? And they said, no, they're not here. Went up to Alaska. You know, he phoned all over the West Coast, basically, and couldn't find these things. And then he was at he started asking every fisheries biologist he met, you know, do you know what happened to the notebooks? And finally, one of them said, "Oh yeah, they're in the back office here in Vancouver." At the
oh yeah, they're just there.
They're just in the back. Yeah. So he went and looked at these things. And you imagine this scene. This is the scene that I just love this. So he opens these boxes, and here are all these little notebooks. And he opens them up, and inside are these scales.
Yeah.
Century old sockeye salmon scales that were, you know, scraped off the side of a fish on its way to the cannery. I mean, these are things that shouldn't even be in the world, right? I mean, and there they are, they're preserved in these notebooks, and he's found them. And of course, what we know now and what Gilbert didn't know back then is that those scales are just a gold mine of information.
So what do they tell us now that we couldn't know back then?
Well, it turns out that they're a record of not only the DNA, because of course they're flesh.
Right.
Salmon, they're flesh, so they've got all the DNA in them. But they also, we now know, well, actually Gilbert knew then, but Gilbert knew that they were a record, but he didn't know that they had all the DNA in them. He couldn't know that part. But what he figured out, one of his great additions to science, was that he could read the rings that are in these scales. So the scales grow along with the salmon, and they contain information about where the salmon lived and how old it is. And so that's what he was looking at. But today, of course, we know that they're, you know, they are flesh, they have DNA, and that's the great finding in the modern era.
What can we do with that knowledge?
Yeah. So what you do, the way I found out about it is that this PhD researcher at Simon Fraser University, whose name is Mike Price, wrote a paper about his analysis of these scales, or at least of some of these scales. So he looked at scales from 1913 to 1923. I think it was something like 3,400 fish he looked at from that period. And he, through using the DNA that's contained in these scales, he reconstructed populations of see what happens with sockeye. These are from the Skeena River system. And they have geographically separate populations. And so he reconstructed the size of these populations back in 1913. And then he compared them, the same populations, to what's happening, how big the populations are today. And that was in this paper.
I probably don't even want to know the results, right?
Well, he was looking at, if you take, this is this really interesting concept in fisheries biology, which was developed by another brilliant Canadian biologist. His name is Daniel Pauly. And he said, you know what, we have to know not what the populations were a couple of decades ago after we'd been fishing these things and, you know, altering the habitat of fish for all these mm-hmm. decades, we have to know what the original populations were. Because if we just look back to the 1960s and we're looking from what could be a deformed baseline.
Instead, and that's where we had data from before.
We had data on sockeye salmon in the Skeena and throughout BC from the 1950s and 60s. And that was thought to be, you know, peak population. And people like Daniel Pauly are saying, well, wait a sec, what if that wasn't peak population? What if declines from that era to today are not the true declines of the population? That mm-hmm. could be meaningful. We could be masking some of the threats. We could be delaying some of the conservation issues. And so that's what Mike Price was looking at. He was saying, well, let's see what the original populations were back from, you know, 1912 mm-hmm. to 1923. Let's just look. And what he discovered was that the populations have absolutely crashed.
Like how much are we talking
well,
about?
The range was between 56% but to 99% within wow. these individual populations. 99%. Once you get to 99%, you're talking about, you know, a total collapse. That's mm-hmm. that's something that may not even be genetically. That's not just in fish. That's in any population. I mean, conservation biology now has standards on these things. And so once you get to 99%, you're really in tough shape.
Meanwhile, we're still fishing these fish?
Episodically, it depends on how many come back through the, like, so they have this formula. And if you're a commercial fishery, and there is a commercial fishery of sockeye salmon in the Skeena watershed, there have to be a certain number of salmon that return to the fresh water from the ocean before there's a threshold. And if there aren't enough fish, then there's a zero catch. So, for example, this past year there were not enough fish coming back from the ocean into the Skeena for any kind of commercial fishery. There's still a recreational fishery.
What's the impact of that on the local economy? Because, I mean, for myself and probably for a lot of people listening, the first thing that comes to mind is the crash of the cod population on
well,
the East Coast.
That's if you talk to Aboriginal Indigenous leaders, and I did that, if you talk to people who rely on the sockeye in the Skeena watershed for food, for tradition, for spiritual nourishment, for, you know, for all of the other ecological processes that the salmon give to that region, because when sockeye die, they feed a whole, they feed trees, they feed, you know, they feed the entire ecosystem there. So if you talk to Indigenous leaders there, they're really worried. They're really worried about what's going to happen. They've seen, you know, they, I mean, we have all these good numbers from scales in this paper, but they've witnessed it over generations, the decline of the sockeye.
Do we know what's caused it? I mean, that's kind of a simple question with probably a huge answer.
Well, it's a huge answer, and they're not exactly sure. I mean, it was interesting because in this paper, Mike Price and his co-authors looked at a bunch of different, they asked themselves the same question, what could it be? And they looked at how degraded the water system, the watershed system, the freshwater system is in the Skeena. It means pollution. It means, you know, is there a lot of deforestation? It means, you know, is there, what else is going on? Are there mines? Are there, you know, is there pulp and paper? You know, all that kind of stuff. And they say that it doesn't explain. The Skeena is pretty remote. It's up on the northwest coast of BC by Prince Rupert. It's not, you know, it's not a hotbed of industrial activity. And so they say that that can't explain what's going on with the salmon. They think it may have more to do with what the salmon experience when they're out in the open ocean, because for a portion of their lives they live in the ocean, and then they have to go back, you know, to the fresh water in order to spawn. So they think that it may have more to do with what's going on in the ocean. But they say, oh, I think the way Mike put it to me was, you know, it's the death of a thousand cuds.
This might be a dumb question, but what does it mean practically to know that the population is this decimated if we didn't know these fish were missing until we found these journals?
Yeah. Is it significant? Well, the risk is that if you think that, you know, the population has only declined by, say, 6 or 7% instead of by, you know, 60 to 80 to 90%, then you're not as worried. You think that there's more resilience within the population. Because the other thing that Mike Price found was that it's not the small fish that are being fished out or that are not returning. It's the big ones, you know. So big ones have a different kind of resilience. They have a different kind of ability to survive the kind of, let's say, the stresses, the trials that they have to go through to reproduce. So you're looking at, you know, problems of a couple of different types. And these are all, we're talking here exclusively about wild salmon, fully wild salmon.
So is there anything being done about this? Are we doing work? Are the fisheries doing work? The government?
The government has said it will monitor this situation, has committed to, this is the federal government we're talking about because it's the federal government that's in charge of this, has said that it will restore habitats, has said that it will work on this. And you talk to biologists in that part of the world, and conservationists and Indigenous leaders, and they say that there's a lot of good faith, for sure, at the federal government level, but it's just not happening very fast. And so there's so little monitoring now happening that the commercial fisheries and canners, the people who take the fish out, have lost their status with the Marine Stewardship Council, which is the international certification system for fish that tells consumers that they're caught sustainably. So we can't certify salmon anymore on the West Coast with that designation because they're monitored so poorly.
How are they monitored now?
Well, there's a trend toward, there's been an arc in this. So originally it was, you know, back in 1912 and to 1948, scrape the scales off the skin.
Like a meticulous process.
A pretty meticulous. And they also had this whole system of this wonderful job description called a creek walker. So these people who knew the creeks intimately would walk them in spawning season and count count the fish and see how many there were. So this is a whole, you know, people devoted their whole lives to that kind of thing.
It kind of sounds like a lovely way to spend your life.
It's, well, these are really remote places. It's not, you can't drive there. You're talking about paddling in. You're talking about walking and figuring this out and making notes and tracking it over time, right? Over the years, over the decades in some cases. So you have this whole system of what were called creek walkers who are now being phased out. And it's not that there's no counting. It's just that it's now, the trend is toward doing it from the air on specific creeks rather than, you know, the way that conservationists would like it to be.
It just seems so strange to me that we know so much more about the severity of this problem now than we did back then. But the way we count and track it seems so much less comprehensive.
We know a lot more about how complex it is. I think that that's got to be true. I mean, back in 1912, they didn't have the same understanding of any of this stuff as what we did. But the interesting thing to me is that Gilbert made those reports through the teens and the 20s. He died in 1928. But even back then, when he was, you know, in the first quarter of the last century, he was saying, you know, we have warning signs here. Things are not going as they should. We have to start thinking about conservation. He became a great conservationist. And of course, it didn't happen, right?
Yeah.
That's the interesting thing to me, is that this stuff is not new. It's a century old, our concern for this stuff. And when you talk to the indigenous leaders of this area, it's very, very somber.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people who are saying, look, we just don't have the fish here. One of the First Nations in that area is saying that we have to have a moratorium for decades on international fishing in the area. Because it's just, we just need time to allow the fish to come back to where they need to be.
That was going to be my last question anyway. Is there a way out of this? I mean, when you talk about like 99% population crash,
right,
it seems like it's already too late in a lot of ways.
That is for one of the populations,
right,
of the 13, but that could, it could, and undoubtedly over the course of this century, there have been populations, not species, but populations that have died out. The thing that is so worth remembering, though, is that it's not just these kinds of signals that Mike Price and other people in that area are picking up are signals of a future extinction.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what this is. It's not, okay, we only have 20 salmon left. It's that this is what it looks like before a species goes extinct, this exact pattern. Or, you know, not fish necessarily, but any kind of pattern when you have broken up, you know, populations that are crashing individually like that within a species. This is the kind of stuff you want to be on the watch for. So it's worth knowing what the situation actually is, because unless we know that, how can we even try to fix it?
It's a damn good thing we found those journals.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alana.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jordan.
Alana Mitchell, science journalist for Maclean's, among other publications. That was The Big Story. If you'd like more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You can also talk to us on Twitter, at TheBigStoryFPN. Is the salmon really an iconic Canadian animal? Share your thoughts, lightly. You can also get this podcast and all the other Frequency Pods wherever you get them, Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you are. Hit that review button if it exists in your app of choice. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.